From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we'll learn how the Cesar Chavez bid is planning this year's Cinco de Mayo celebration differently.
It can be a little chaotic if you would describe it, right? People, if you ask them, they'll say chaotic. But it is also a way that people are looking to celebrate and embrace their identity.
Then we'll tell you about a documentary showing at the Milwaukee Film Fest about Italian cookbook writer Marcella Hazan.
I've been cooking her recipes for decades, and every night I go to the kitchen thinking, what do I do with this ingredient? And the answer is, you know, what would Marcella do?
Plus, we'll look at this April Zine Fest held at Milwaukee Central Library. All that's coming up on Lake Effect, but first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us today. Cinco de Mayo is a day when Mexican Americans celebrate their heritage. Here in Milwaukee, that can mean a lot of things: parties, fireworks, and some less than desirable driving. Generally, the festivities take place on the city's south side, where Milwaukee's Latino community is concentrated. And Cesar Chavez Drive has often been the center of activity. So this year, the Cesar Chavez bid has organized a street festival and market to celebrate the holiday in a safe way, blocking off the street with vendors and activities for people of all ages. Sinaí Mendoza is the executive director of the Cesar Chavez Business Improvement District, or BID. She joins Lake Effect's Joy Powers to share more.
Anyone who lives on the south side knows that Cinco de Mayo really brings people out into the area, into the streets, for better or worse. What is Cinco de Mayo generally like on Cesar Chavez?
Yeah, I mean, in the last couple of years, we've had a group of people, you know, coming out, celebrating, driving their cars around the street with their flags. Unfortunately, hasn't been organized as it should be, right? There has no been an organization really putting these groups together and allowing for the space for healthy and safe celebrations to happen. I mean, that's the narrative, right? I think some of us have seen it on social media, also on the news. It can be a little chaotic if you would describe it, right? People, if you ask them, they'll say chaotic. But it is also a way that people are looking to celebrate and embrace their identity. So, yeah.
It's a hard line to walk because I think a lot of people want to see celebration, of course, but then there's the concern over reckless driving, the concern over the safety of vehicles in general. What are some of the concerns that you hear from folks in the neighborhood?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. You said it, right? Reckless driving, that is the biggest concern. It not only affects the individuals that are driving themselves, but also the pedestrians or other neighbors, right? Their cars could be crashed or cause all sorts of commotions that do not need to happen. But the big concern is the reckless driving that is going on. Also, small gatherings or like gatherings that can get out of hand. There's no supervision. People can get in altercations and then things can get out of hand, right? Where there's no police or safety around it. And you know, everyone just kind of does whatever they want. So that's been some of the concern. But yeah.
So as the Cesar Chavez BID, mm-hmm. how have you guys responded to kind of the concerns, but also the desire to have a celebration?
Yeah, so 16th Street, Cesar Chavez Drive, is a pretty historical street, right? The BID has been around for 20 years, but the street itself, it's been there. It's home and a lot of immigrants, Latino immigrants of the South Side. We have some of the biggest stores in there. We have Array. We also have 16th Street Clinic, who have done amazing work supporting our community. And so the street itself is pretty historical. It's Cesar Chavez, a famous activist, right, labor rights. So there's meaning on the street. There's identity to that. And what we've done as a bit in my last year or so is organize spaces where people can still, they embrace their identity, right? Whether it is your Latinidad, your Mexicanes, whatever that is. We want to make sure that people are seen and that they're having spaces that are controlled and they can have fun, right? Show a different way of of having fun. We don't need to be driving around the streets up and down, putting other individuals at risk. But maybe we can just gather together, have a bunch of activities for our children. We want to make sure that the kids, the youth, are also involved in this process and show them there's a different alternative. There's a different way to celebrating, a safer way to celebrating.
So what is that alternative going to look like? Now, I should say Cinco de Mayo itself is going to be a Monday.
Mm-hmm.
This will be on the weekend, I believe. So
yes, so this will be on the weekend, on Sunday, the day before to May 5th. So for this celebration, we have put together an outdoor market. We want to support our local businesses in the area, not only the ones that are in the corridor, but also all the other businesses that are starting and then they find markets throughout the summer. Right now, the economy is not at its best, right? So we want to make sure that these businesses are also supportive and then we're all showing up as a community and being there for each other. And more than anything, too, changing the narrative of kind of what happens on Chavez Drive. People oftentimes don't feel safe or like maybe going around the neighborhood walking because the reckless driving, you know, is not for me, like shalala, whatever narrative it's out there. But the space itself is fulfilled with beautiful stories, with businesses who have been there for 20 plus years. And there's some of the sweetest people, like resilient people that you can ever meet, right? It just takes that opportunity, that space for you to connect with them. So this year we'll be doing that. We have an open outdoor market. We have about 40, 50 vendors. We have food trucks. We have all sorts of vendors. And then we have about 20 plus community resources. We have different organizations that will be joining us. There's a heavy emphasis on youth resources. The summer is coming, right? We want parents to have resources for their children, activities that they could do throughout the summer, you know, camps or things that they can sign them up so they can have some fun. And then we also have a variety of activities that we'll be doing. We have a lowrider exhibition. The first hour and a half of the event will be open for people to ride their bikes. Children, we also have a bike workshop. So that's part of, you know, including this healthy moving around the city narrative as well. And we're partnering up with organizations like Oakley Familia, who is a Latino cycling club. We have different performances, Aztec dance, folklore. And one of the things that I'm really, really excited about is that we will be having a brainstorm session for a mural that will be going up in September for our Hispanic Heritage Month celebration, which will happen same on 16th Street. But those are some of the things that will be going on. There's lots of food, music. So please, I encourage you all to come out to enjoy the celebrations and more than anything, to experience community.
Very nice. So are you guys closing off a part of Cesar Chavez?
Yeah, we are closing from 16 on Greenfield all the way to 16 on Mineral. So that is like 2.5 blocks. It is a bit, once you look at it, it's like in a map, it doesn't look that big, but it is a pretty big chunk of a space to cover. So yeah, from Greenfield on 16 to Mineral on 16th Street.
Very nice. I'm sure that'll help also with folks who might be driving down Cesar Chavez to at least divert them a bit.
Correct. So the lateral streets too will be blocked as well, obviously, for the safety of our participants, for people to come out. But yeah, so then that way it kind of blocks so people don't go south or north on 16th Street. It just clusters right in the center of the neighborhood.
Well, looking forward to it. Thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Absolutely.
Sinaí Mendoza is the executive director of the Cesar Chavez bid, and she spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers. The Cinco de Mayo outdoor market will be held this Sunday, May 4th, on Cesar Chavez Drive, with things kicking off at 1 o'clock. A new documentary screening at the Milwaukee Film Festival explores the city's historic Brady Street neighborhood from its earliest roots to present day and its eras of immigration.
And very quickly, by the early 50s, this neighborhood became an Italian neighborhood, flipped it, and it almost, for the most part, became known as the Little Italy of Milwaukee.
Brady Street, Portrait of a Neighborhood, was made over the course of 2 years by more than 80 UW-Milwaukee film students and directed by Sean Kafer. He joins Lake Effects expert Nunez to talk about the making of the documentary.
For people who live outside the Milwaukee area and aren't familiar with Brady Street, can you introduce us to it?
Yeah, I think I'd like to say that Brady Street might be something different to everybody. It's widely known for its nightlife, really good food, restaurants. But yeah, it's a place that has a rich history and a Polish population and the Italian population that moved there at a certain time. And then also for the counterculture that it was really well known for in the 60s, 70s, and even still kind of today.
Right. And in this documentary, the story of Brady Street is told through historians, neighborhood residents, and various business owners in the area. I'm curious, how did you and your students build out the blueprint of where to start with Brady Street's story and who the sources would be?
I love that question. We just started off with Frank Aliotto, who was a historian and wrote a book about the neighborhood. And from there, we asked him who to talk to, and we reached out to other people. We kind of kept letting it grow. We would ask maybe about two people that we could talk to. And we see it was kind of let it grow further and further and further. And we didn't have a blueprint. And going into it right away, we knew that we didn't. But there were some important people that were given to us through the Business Improvement District also. So I think my favorite part about it is that it grew organically without a game plan going into it.
Yeah, and I think that almost makes it even more authentic. And in the documentary, you focus on various immigrant communities at different points in Milwaukee's history, including Polish immigrants. It was interesting for me to learn how they built foundational parts of the city. Can you talk about the early Polish era in the Brady Street area?
Yeah, the Polish population came when the tanneries came. So a number of tanneries are lined up on the river where we see apartment houses and condos now. And at the time, the cheap labor was the Polish immigrant. But that was the group at the time period that you could pay less. And they would work at the industry, in the leather industry there. And how they came and built their houses up was they took a lot of recycled materials from different parts of town, brought it over, and eventually you create a really small house. And then maybe you'd build up and put brick around the bottom, and that would be your Polish flat that we now know today. And that they also might, instead of having a backyard, they might put another house in the back, and maybe that was the parents' house or another family member's place. So it's a very condensed neighborhood with all of its Polish flats, and you can't always see the backyards, but the backyards might have one or two houses back there.
Yes, very family-oriented, and it was interesting, too, to learn about, you know, the Polish immigrants were a very hard-working community and that their religion meant so much to them that they built the St. Hedwig Church.
Yeah, that's correct. Beautiful church. I think it was a smaller church at first, but then over time, as more funds were collected, they got to build the beautiful St. Hedwig's. Before that, Frank Aliotto shares with us that they would make a pilgrimage all the way down to the south side, St. Stanislaus, I think, which they were walking to. So that's like maybe, I don't know, 4 or 5 miles, but doing that every Sunday is a pilgrimage. And then coming back, like you're making an event all day long just to try to get to church. So it was essential for them to build this. And it's now kind of like the center of the street.
And another group you focus on is Italian immigrants in Milwaukee. You spoke with some people who were there in the 1940s and 50s. What are some of the stories you heard from people who moved straight from Sicily to Wisconsin?
Yeah, well, one of the first places that they occupied was they'd come to the Third Ward and then kind of worked their way up to the Brady Street area and started a lot of businesses. You might find a lot of Italian delis, grocery stores, markets, and whatnot. But I think it's fascinating. We get to learn that, especially in Sicily, most of the Italian population that come here are from Sicily, but we do talk to somebody, Rosalia, who's from mainland Italy. But there was not much industry, especially in Sicily. I know Mima Orlando shares with us that it's either fishing or something else, and there's not much. So you come here because there's industries so you can make some money to raise a family. And we get to hear about Amima coming, actually being a child bride, which I think is an important story for us to hear. And remember, that's how people came here that way. And this is a part for history we want to keep inside of our documents and our books.
Right. And it was definitely an emotional moment in the documentary. And there are also a few turning points in the film, but one that really stood out to me was Brady Street's history in the 70s and 80s, a time where a lot of businesses closed and people weren't on the street for good reasons. Can you talk about this rise and this fall?
Yeah, it's interesting because it's all shared with people that had businesses on the street or really close to a part of this neighborhood at this time. And from my understanding, what we get to learn in the film is, well, Brady Street Festival stops happening. Brady Street Fest at one point in the 70s was a pretty raucous, pretty wild thing. You know, not everybody loved hippies, people getting drunk, and when we hear peeing in the yard a lot, or just like sleeping in the yard, and like a lot of the residents didn't like that. So an older person stops it. But when the people didn't have a place to go anymore, it became kind of like a ghost town. A lot of the windows would be boarded up. Different people try to come in there and rehabilitate the neighborhood. And there's some wins and there's some losses in there. But it takes almost 20 years for it to really to grow again. But it takes this time where rent is cheap in the street because it's not a very desired street anymore. So people get to experiment and come in there and try something out that's kind of different. Where we have our Mima Orlando comes in there, builds this Italian restaurant. I think she says there's 3 or 4 tables. And then by the end, I can't remember how many she had because it became like a banquet kind of place also. But this allows other people to come in and experiment. It also makes the neighborhood rich as it evolves, and you have different cultures coming in, and you know, we'll have like a Thai restaurant come in, and we have the Diplomat, which is a James Beard awarding restaurant. We have a Brazilian coffee shop, and we still have our Italian bakery or delis too, and our old pizza place like Zaffiro's. But these kind of rehabilitations in neighborhoods allow other groups and different people to come in, and kind of makes it that rich neighborhood that it is.
Something that really struck me when watching the documentary is that all of the people you spoke to felt so passionate about how living and working in Brady Street has meant so much to their lives. Why do you think that is?
I think it's the connection that people see each other and they know each other. Again, I didn't necessarily go to the bar life when I first came to Milwaukee, but it'd be the coffee shops on Brady Street. And like I would get to meet people and people would say hi. You don't necessarily know the names, but you start feeling like a part of the community. And I think the students along the way started feeling that same thing too. They maybe had interviewed someone and they'd see that person and there'd be connections there. And now they felt like they're part of the community. But it's people maybe that don't know each other like best friends, but they know each other, and there's something warm about that. And I think that's why a lot of times we like to come back to our urban settings so we feel like a part of a community, which is a good feeling.
Absolutely. And someone who kind of ties the whole story together for me is Mark Denning, who is enrolled with the Oneida Tribe of Wisconsin and a cultural speaker and educator with UW-Milwaukee. Can you talk about how he establishes the evolution of Brady Street?
I think he's essential to the film because we often think of our history of just European settlers coming in, but we have to remember that there were people here for tens of thousands of years before that. And he reminds us of what different native tribes, how they used the land and the water and how important it was and how it was this meeting place because we have this confluence of three rivers where trade and agriculture and fishing can all happen. So he brings it together and kind of gives us a beginning of what it was like. And I don't want to say too much about the end, but I'll say that he gives a positive outlook for Milwaukee and the rivers and the environment.
Definitely. And you've already shown the film a couple of times, maybe with the community. What has been the initial reaction from people?
Well, we've only shown clips so far, so we actually haven't even had a full in a lot of way the announcements go out. It sounds like we're showing the whole film, but we've just been given teasers so far. But the responses have been really great. I think the very first time we showed it with a couple of the Business Improvement District members, one person, I remember crying because it touched her so much, a person that had grown up in the neighborhood and is a business owner in the neighborhood still. I think it's going to touch a lot of people. And then some people say, hey, you know, you left out that three-legged dog that everybody knew 100 years ago. Why are there these small things? But yeah, we're always going to miss some of those things, but that's for the residents to remember, and that's important. But I think people that have maybe been in this neighborhood 40 years ago, 50 years ago, or maybe even 10 years ago are going to come back and see, like, oh, my gosh, that's why it felt like maybe I couldn't articulate why it felt like such a special place. But now seeing it and hearing the stories, maybe now I understand.
Yeah, and I think people, too, maybe that have lived here or are new to Milwaukee, like myself, I just feel a little more appreciative of the Brady Street neighborhood after watching this documentary. And, you know, this was a long-running project in the making for you and your students. What do you think the more than 80 students who worked on production took away from making this documentary?
Well, I think they took away, first off, they got to learn how to be on a real production. And for many of them, if not most of them, if not all of them, this might be their first real big-time production that they're doing. So getting to work together, but then also becoming part of the neighborhood. A lot of our students at UW-Milwaukee, we have a very rich and diverse student body, but many of them come from places that are maybe not as condensed and urban as this. So getting into these neighborhoods and feeling these kind of connections, I could see it in the students and like in their face and in their eyes and in their smile that they're connecting with the community and they liked it. And I have to give props to the film department, Department of Film, Video, Animations, and New Genres at UW-Milwaukee in the Peck School of the Arts, because one thing that we're always trying to do is we're trying to give our students more experiences where they can get out there in the real world and do some professional experiences or take a different path in film, because we're a very diverse film program where there's a lot of different options. We're well known for our underground filmmaking, which has been spectacular, and other things too. Animation is an area that we're growing in. But we also do documentary too, so I just want to make sure that everybody knows how rich and the opportunities that the students have in our film department.
Well, Sean, thank you so much for speaking with me today and sharing this project with me.
Hey, it's been my pleasure.
Sean Kafer is the program director of DocUWM and director of Brady Street, Portrait of a Neighborhood. He spoke with LakeFX expert Nunez. You can see the film this Friday and Sunday as a part of the Milwaukee Film Festival. Did you know you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast? Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to download and listen on demand. In about 15 minutes, we'll head to the Milwaukee Central Library where Zine Fest drew a big crowd earlier this month. But first, we'll hear from the director of a documentary on a beloved Italian cookbook writer. That's coming up on Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. There's a film for food lovers at this year's Milwaukee Film Festival. It's called Marcella. It's named after the late Marcella Hazan, the Italian-born cookbook author. WUWM's Mayan Silver is joined by Peter Miller, who directed and produced the film.
First of all, I just watched the film, and Milwaukee gets mentioned in the film. Are you familiar with that? Did you know that? One of the people you speak with says that she has a book tours, signing in places like Milwaukee.
Oh, the astute watcher will notice that Milwaukee gets a mention, which is just an amazing thing that you saw that. So, you know, Marcella has mattered so much in people's lives. I mean, and I'm among those people. I've been cooking her recipes for decades, and every night I go to the kitchen thinking, what do I do with this ingredient? And the answer is, you know, what would Marcella do? And Marcella's a voice in my head, and I, you know, she really means something to me. And clearly she meant something to parents across the country. There's any number of kids who were named Marcella for her. And in the film, there's one of our interviews says, you know, Marcella would be at a book signing somewhere in the country, Milwaukee, Los Angeles. And somebody would come up to her and say, I name my baby for you. And it made Marcella cry.
That's hilarious.
Yes.
So one of the clips that I wanted to play for you is Marcella's voice herself. You know, we want to introduce people to her if they aren't familiar with her. And there's this clip right here. She is in a market in Italy, and she's talking about the food.
The one who has the higher price is written a word that is nostrani, that means local. They cost much more. And the people is willing to pay more because they were really fresh.
And basically it's where Italian produce is labeled that way if it's directly from the local area. What was the importance of that, like, to her and to her life?
So now, Marcella was really committed to eating the best ingredients, cooking with the best ingredients, and the best ingredients usually meant something that came from nearby, something that came from your community that had what they call nostrana, which means ours. And if the ingredients are better, if you're working with Parmigiano Reggiano cheese, or if you're working with good extra virgin olive oil or produce that comes from a farm nearby, it's just going to be a better experience and you're going to have better food. You know, Marcella's recipes were not complicated. She wasn't a restaurant chef making fancy dishes. She was making food for home cooks and recipes that home cooks could follow. But if you follow those instructions, which is cook simply and according to wonderful tradition, and choose good local ingredients, I mean, that just makes such a difference. And she was saying this stuff long before we had the farm-to-table movement and farmers markets everywhere. This was something she learned from her experience of being Italian.
And so there are so many cool things about Marcella that you learn in this movie. For instance, she taught herself to cook. I mean, that's kind of a fabulous kind of idea that she ends up learning all these techniques just on her own. I mean, what did you learn about her journey there?
You know, this is a film about cooking and about food, but it's really the story of an amazing person's journey through life. Marcella was a scientist. She had two PhDs in science. She never cooked until she got married and went with her Italian expat husband back to the United States. And he asked her to put a meal on the table every day. She said, I'd never boiled water unless it was in the beaker in the laboratory before. I mean, this is a person who was highly overqualified for this task, but she wanted to put a meal on the table in America, and she got an Italian cookbook, and she reverse engineered those flavors that she remembers from her life in Italy. She was entirely self-taught, but soon she was giving Italian cooking lessons, and she was such a brilliant mind that she was able to translate what she remembered from Italian cooking to Americans who wanted to learn how to cook this magnificent cuisine.
Also, the way she measured, I'm guessing there's a lot of chefs that are like that too, but there was a clip in the film from one of her friends, Bill, who's in the movie, and he's talking about taking cooking lessons with Marcella.
And I said, Marcella, your recipes are so precise. I can't believe that you just threw all that salt in the pot. And she said, I never measure anything. She said, and now you cook it. And I said, with my pencil poised, for how long? And she looked at me with great disdain and said, till it's done.
And Bill gives a great big smile there. Can you talk about how that sort of epitomizes her approach to food?
Well, Marcella would say that Italian cooking is simple, but it's not easy. I mean, it's often you're making recipes that have just two or three or four ingredients. I mean, her famous tomato sauce with tomato and onion and half a stick of butter and salt, that's all there is. But if you follow her instructions, it's the most magical sauce you could ever make. And so much of what she taught us is about simplicity and technique, about really following your instincts, but also following handed down knowledge. And so, yeah, her recipes are super precise. They tell you exactly how much stuff. But in reality, Marcella never measured. She'd throw in what she thought there should be. And so there's this kind of paradox, which is that she's giving incredibly precise ingredients, but she's encouraging you to use your wisdom and to tap into common sense. She says the most important ingredient in the kitchen is common sense.
That's amazing. I read that one of the reasons you actually got the idea to do a documentary on her was when you were preparing ravioli with your wife. How has she seeped into your life? Can you talk about that a little bit?
Pretty much every night when my wife and I go to the kitchen and cook, and we love to cook. You know, the two things I love to do are make documentary films and make dinner. And, you know, most nights we're there looking at our produce or looking at our meat and saying, okay, what are we gonna cook tonight? And Marcella has been this steady presence in our consciousness. It's not just the fact that her recipes are great. It's that there's this voice in her writing. She's such an amazing writer. And of course, a lot of her writing is in collaboration with her brilliant husband, who, you know, was behind the scenes crafting this prose with her. But I'd be, you know, in the kitchen reading her thing, and I can hear her voice scolding and cajoling and instructing. She's just this larger-than-life presence in my own life. And, you know, one night after we just got the crazy idea to make homemade ravioli, you know, a couple hours into the process, because there's a lot of work there. You've got to roll the dough, and you've got to make the stuffing, and you've got to build them. My wife looked at me and said, has anyone ever made a documentary about Marcella? And I looked at the internet and I saw that nobody seemed to have. I contacted her son, Giuliano, who's also a great cooking teacher. He was easy to find because he offers cooking classes. So I reached out to him and he said, no, but I'd love that. But you got to talk to my dad. And I said, your dad? I had no idea Victor was still around. He was well into his 90s at that point. And I called up Victor the next day and he said, I'd love for you to do this. By the way, I'm in Florida and you're in New York. I'm coming up to your part of the world in the next couple weeks. Why don't you interview me? So I thought, this is just, you know, I'm being instructed by higher powers to do this. He came to my living room. I interviewed him for 3.5 hours. He was the most brilliant, articulate interview I've ever conducted, and we were off and running.
That was Victor.
That was Victor. Victor came to my house, delivered the most extraordinary interview, full of stories and insights and poetry. The guy was brilliant, and we were off and running. I mean, it was clear this film had to get made.
And one of the things that struck me about Marcella's biography is her hand injury. Here's a clip of her son, Giuliano, talking about the assistance she'd have to make things like homemade pasta.
I think the fact that she hurt her hand and it never went back to being what it was. It was very difficult for her to do things with her right hand. But it never stopped her from doing anything. I remember that she would tell her students often, you know, if I can do this with 1.5 arms, then you should have no trouble doing it.
What can you tell us about this injury and how it shaped her, really, and how she kind of became someone to emulate on that regard?
Well, this is a story about cooking, but it's also a story about disability. I mean, Marcella had injured her arm as a child, and it never got better. Her right hand, and she was right-handed, was really barely functional, and she had to hold a knife with it, and she had to work with this disability in order to prepare fantastic meals, which would be a challenge for anybody. But in some sense, you could say that maybe that disability was part of how she got her willfulness. And, you know, this is a person who was extremely strong-minded and strong-willed and, you know, would tell you what she was thinking and nothing would stop her. And, you know, does that come back to having to deal with this disability as a child? I mean, this is a different era for disability. Now people might say, this is my condition. There are ways in which to work with it. But back then, it was something of shame. I mean, she would hide her disabled right arm, but underneath a sheath. She'd keep it behind. You look at the photos, and oftentimes she's got her hand out of the frame, you know, because this was something that she did not feel good about. She didn't love watching herself on television with her injured right hand. Thank goodness times have changed and we approach disability in a different way now. This was something that I think really did shape her.
She nonetheless wrote many, many cookbooks in Italian. Her husband would translate them. You know, she won 7 James Beard Awards. She was just someone who continued in this sort of mission of spreading good food and good eating in Italian ways. I was wondering what you think someone like Marcella would say about the food and recipe scene of 2025, you know, with Instagram and quick cooking videos and, you know, anybody with video skills being able to produce food videos and travel videos and what I eat in a day videos. How do you think she'd relate to that?
See, Marcella was all about flavor, and she was all about feeding delicious food to people you love. She's a person who wrote books for home cooks to prepare good meals to sit at a table and enjoy together. She was never about flash and presentation. She was never about photographable, Instagrammable food. That wouldn't be who she was. If you look at her great cookbooks, you know, the classic Italian cookbook and its follow-up and then Essentials of Classic Italian Cuisine, these books are barely illustrated. There's no glossy photos. There might be a drawing to show you how to dismantle an artichoke or how to do something in your kitchen. But it was the text, it was the messages in the book that mattered. It wasn't the pictures. It wasn't putting it on a plate in a little pile with, you know, doodads around it. This was solid, delicious food prepared lovingly for people you love.
There's a great quote in your documentary where someone says she may have minced garlic, but she never minced words. I love that quote. Did you ever experience that with her in person?
You know, my wife and I would have loved to have gone to her cooking class in Venice. It was, you know, for a whole week you could go there and learn from the greatest cookbook writer in the world, you know, in Venice, and you go to the markets there and all, but it was way beyond what we could afford. I mean, it was thousands of dollars and that wasn't something we could do. But one night in the 90s, Marcella was coming to Connecticut, like a couple hours away from where we live, to give a one evening cooking demonstration. And so we got babysitting and we went out to the suburbs and we went and met Marcella. We saw her cook and then we snuck up to her, you know, because this is part of being a documentary filmmaker is I have to be fearless. And so I went and I got my wife and I up next to her. We sat down. She had a glass of Jack Daniels and a cigarette, as she would often do. And she was Marcella. And we went up to her and said, "So nice to meet you. It's, you know, such an honor. We cook your food all the time. And by the way, there's this one recipe that we wanted to ask you about because it's got a sauce. And sometimes it comes out brilliantly, but sometimes we put the butter in at the last minute and the sauce breaks." And she looked at my wife and she said, "The sauce does not break." And what she was saying was, "The problem, honey, is not me. It's not my recipe. It's you." And we're like,
"It's you.
Oh, my goodness. We've been insulted by Marcella Hazan. Our life is complete."
Lovely. It sounds like from the documentary that she inspired a lot of love among people. She was a very kind person, but she wasn't afraid to say what she thought.
That's really the story of Marcella. She's a, you know, she didn't have the filters to, you know, but it was all coming from a place of love and kindness. And so she might complain loudly about something, but from all reports, she was a wonderful, loving friend.
Peter Miller, thank you so much for chatting with us about your new documentary, Marcella.
Thank you so much for having me on. Piccolo fiore.
That was Peter Miller, director of Marcella, speaking with WUWM's Mayon Silver. You can catch the film at the Milwaukee Film Festival this afternoon at 4 p.m. at the Oriental, and it will be available to stream on major platforms starting Friday, May 9th. Milwaukee Film is a financial contributor to WUWM. We'll take one more break, and when we come back, we'll learn about the annual Zine Fest held at Milwaukee Central Library and what sets that medium apart. That's coming up on Lake Effect on WUWM. Come tu sai, si può soffrire. E qualche volta si può anche morire, come io per te, come io per te. Degli occhi tuoi non so il colore. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. This April, Milwaukee Zine Fest saw hundreds of vendors and alt literature fans pack Milwaukee's Central Library for a celebration of DIY publishing, free expression, and print media. WUWM digital producer Graham Thomas was there and has this report.
Public libraries are often thought of as solemn spaces, reserved for quiet study and filled with old books collecting dust. But the library is much more than that. And Milwaukee Zine Fest is just one example.
I like to refer to this as the loudest, best day at the library. It's the day where we really smash that idea that the library is a quiet study place, at least for 24 hours.
That's Timothy Rush, rare books librarian for Milwaukee Public Library.
And it's also like the biggest day of the library right now. It's with the day that we get the most foot traffic through the building, so this is getting folks to come out to the library.
124 vendors and hundreds of alt literature fans packed Milwaukee's Central Library for April's Zine Fest. The annual event is a collaboration between Milwaukee Public Library and The Bindery, a book factory in Bayview that serves as a creative hub for small press publishing. Now you may be wondering, what is a zine? The Bindery's Zach Lifton explains.
So it's a little bit tricky, but basically it's an independent published work that somebody is producing on their own rather than through a traditional method like a publishing house. It's typically something simple, easy to create at home, and then can be distributed through very low to the ground grassroots means like a festival or amongst friends.
For Lizzie Madsen, it's the accessibility of zine making that drew her and her partner Mads to the medium.
Very accessible. You can write or design however you would like, scan it in, print it off. If you go to your local library, it's probably going to be 10 cents a copy or less. And it's a great way to get information out there and meet like-minded people without all the barriers to entry of traditional publishing or traditional ways of spreading your art.
The Madsens traveled all the way from Minneapolis for this year's Zine Fest. Taking inspiration from YouTube creators like Breeze Zine Club, the couple started making their own zines under the name Hunter Moon Press earlier this year.
Well, the one I'm most excited about is Paul the Park Ranger. It's a little introduction zine. Our goal for this year is to make like a full like indie comic. So that's the one I'm most excited about probably. It's about a trans park ranger and it's very fun.
For writer Luke Geddes, zines offer an alternative outlet to participate in a visual medium.
You know, I've always really been into these underground or alternative self-published comics, but I don't have artistic skills. So sort of my entryway to be able to participate in that culture is through zines.
Geddes' zine, TV Grime, is a play on the old TV Guide magazine. It's a serialized work that traffics in television nostalgia, combining cultural criticism with personal retrospective.
And I have a few issues that have different themes, but like the most popular ones are the Halloween issue, which is my reviews and reflections on every Halloween-themed TV episode I've ever seen in my life of wataching a lot of TV. And then a Twin Peaks issue that's sort of about the web of influence that Twin Peaks had on culture that followed it, especially like other TV shows.
In 2020, Simon & Schuster published Luke Geddes' first novel, Heart of Junk. So he's no stranger to traditional publishing. But he has a particular soft spot for the DIY charm and disarming intimacy of zine culture.
I think just also the intimacy of it, it's something that's, you know, sometimes it's handwritten, it's almost always like hand stapled and bound, so you feel like, you feel like you have more of a connection with the person who made it, and it feels like, it has that spark of like reading someone's diary almost.
It's that intimacy that makes zines so attractive to many today. Take Ian Izzard's zine, Electric Dream, a deeply personal work that explores his experience of digital alienation.
It's a book kind of about technology and like my own personal relationship to the internet, but also a more general relationship to technology today in terms of like seeking validation from it and kind of like, where do we get our identity from? Is it from ourselves or is it from society? And then, you know, how is society then influenced by technology and kind of the interplay and cross-pollination there. So that's the project as a whole, but it's mostly very depressing and sad, but in like a fun, beautiful way.
For Izzard, ZineFest evokes a feeling of artistic community and an opportunity to participate in face-to-face culture.
I feel like that's the best part, is just like keeping up with people, getting to see what they're doing. We all get to be in the same place at the same time, and you know, it's really easy to find new stuff that way.
Colleen Harris of Dog Eye Press puts it like this.
We love talking about how zines and books are just portals, like portals into another world. And it's something that you can create another world and then just hand it off to someone and then they take it with them and you never know where it's going to go.
For librarian Max Yella, zines create a unique social bond between artist and audience.
The zine is something that you hold in your hand. It's a one-on-one experience. You experience it in accumulated fragments. So that expression is what I really love about zines. And I love the fact that they're DIY, that you don't have to depend on a publisher. You're the maker, you're the publisher, you're the distributor.
Yela is head of special collections at UWM, and he's worked closely with Central Library on their zine archive, a collection that helped kickstart ZineFest back in 2008.
This is what I love. And so sitting behind the desk like this and watch people interact with materials in this way it really jazzes me.
Rare Books librarian Timothy Rush puts it this way.
Zines are great because they allow somebody to put their thoughts into the world without like any sort of filter or, you know, need to change up what they're writing because they're trying to publish for a specific audience or it's what the publisher thinks should be made.
From transcendentalism to surrealism to 70s punk and 90s feminism, the zine has been a consistent fellow traveler of radical artistic and political movements. Cartoonist Susan Semensky-Biedela cut her teeth as an activist artist in the 60s, and she's been coming to Milwaukee Zine Fest since the beginning. She sees independent art as a site of resistance.
The role of artists is to resist authoritarianism. And I'm part of a collective that certainly does that because we touch all the topics that we're not supposed to talk about. We support Palestine, even though most of us are Jewish, and we're against genocide. We support political prisoners. We support women's rights, we support the right to health care and all of the other things that are being threatened right now.
Biedela is a contributor and co-editor for World War III Illustrated, a leftist comics anthology published by AK Press. Last summer, her comic strip Big Sister is Watching You was included as part of a gallery event at the St. Kate Hotel during the Republican National Convention. However, she says the piece was removed.
Lo and behold, the night of the show opening, the St. Kate Hotel, art hotel, managers and owners took the art down. And they said that it was too inciting to riot for the Republicans, and were afraid that damage would be done to the hotel from a comic that's called Big Sister is Watching You, about the book banning moms groups.
Biedela says events like ZineFest are important bastions of free speech at a time when it's under threat.
Things are being censored in the arts, and I think it's only beginning.
For the Bindery's Zach Lifton, zines are the perfect medium for amplifying diverse perspectives.
And I also really love that they are a way for all different types of diverse voices to be out in the world in a way that maybe traditional publishing wouldn't be capturing them or marginalizing those voices to the side. So zines are a great way for everybody to participate in print.
For Lake Effect, I'm Graham Thomas.
That report wraps up Lake Effect for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Joy Powers, Sam Woods, and X-Grid Nunez join me in producing Lake Effect each week with help from Rob Larry and Graham Thomas. Becky Mortensen is our executive producer. Emily Files helps edit the show. We also heard from Jimmy Gutierrez, Eddie Morales, and Mayan Silver from the WUWM news team this week. Jason Reevy is our studio engineer. Michelle Maternowski is our digital manager. Valeria Navarro-Viegas is our digital editor. Trapper Shep wrote our theme music. If you've missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, simply download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you listen to your podcasts. Join us again on Monday at noon to learn about the film Unseen, which explores the intersections of immigration, disability, and mental health. Thank you so much for joining us today, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.